Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay.
The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court.
Unless there is any more question, we have to find an argument in this case.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention.
Welcome to Divided Argument, an unscheduled, unpredictable Supreme Court podcast. I'm Will Bode.
And I'm Dan Epps. So, Will, speaking of unscheduled, has been a while since we recorded.
We have, yeah.
It's been a good while. I think we have a good excuse, though. Do you know what that is?
No, I'd love one.
Supply chain problems. Our hot takes have actually been on a shipping container that's been stuck in the port of Los Angeles for a long time. So, sorry about that. Hopefully, these days, supply chain problems really kind of holds everything up. So, not our fault. But we are back. And let's talk a little bit about what's happened in our absence, but then we actually have a bigger topic we're going to talk about in a moment. So
the Supreme Court decided to overrule Roe versus Wade, right?
Well, they haven't said so yet, but that statement might be literally true. And the court has conference in that case, and it is based on how that argument went. It is very conceivable that five justices came out of that conference, went into that conference and said, I will vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. The statement you made may literally be true, even if it isn't public yet. But yeah, and that argument, I think heading into that argument, we had kind of talked about this a little bit in our episodes last term. And I think that you actually came down on the fact that like maybe this is going to be the one where they really, really do take on the challenge Roe versus Wade based on how you read the question presented. And I think that based on how the argument went, it does seem like maybe that's right.
Yeah, well, at least Mississippi seems to have read the question presented the same way. So they came in with a full-throated argument for returning, and both sides were very uninterested in any kind of half measures, even though some of the justices, like the Chief Justice, were desperately trying to sell some half measures.
Yeah, I mean, it was really just the Chief Justice, at least among the conservative justices, I thought. He was really pushing this argument that maybe we just get rid of the viability line. He was like looking at Justice Blackmun's private papers and then
condemning them. He called them,
yeah, but then relying on them, saying, oh, it's not great that we have these, but I'm going to read them and suggest that maybe there's support in there. Maybe he thought that the viability line was just dicta, so we don't have to follow it, but also it's bad that his papers are public. That was weird. But yeah, it seemed like there were multiple votes to overrule.
And, well, definitely multiple. The question is the number.
Yeah, no, but maybe more than we were certain about. In particular, I think heading into this, you might have thought Justice Kavanaugh is one of the kind of more uncertain votes because maybe there's a Robertsian compromise that he goes along with, and his questions or his statements at oral argument really made me think that he's not going to compromise. He is all in favor of overturning Roe versus Wade and returning the issue to the states.
Right. Although I think what was interesting is he kept framing that as a compromise. You know, he kept saying, yeah, abortion could be constitutionally protected. It could be unconstitutional, as some countries have held and as some people argue, or we could take the studiously neutral position of overruling Roe versus Wade and leaving it to the legislature.
Yeah.
But I mean, once he said it, that sounded just like, Justice Kavanaugh. I just hadn't anticipated that was going to be the frame he'd pick.
Yeah, and he had this kind of speech about, that was sort of phrased in the form of a question about, like, wouldn't it have been bad if the court hadn't been willing to overturn Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown, and kind of talking about other cases where the court overturned precedent. So I think that he seems pretty likely. I think that, you know, heading in, I think it would be pretty easy to assume that Justice Thomas and Justice Alito were pretty likely to want to overturn Roe.
I think Justice Gorsuch has said so, I think.
Has he explicitly said so? I don't remember.
I thought he joined one of those opinions last year.
Yeah, but yeah, maybe he did. Ex ante, you would have thought, you know, that's the kind of case where you might expect him to kind of travel with Justices Thomas and Alito with a little dose of uncertainty about like where he stands on social issues based on Bostock.
Not on where he stands on substantive process.
Yeah, well, depends on what you make of Bostock, right?
Depends on whether you think law matters. Depends on whether you think law matters to him.
I think it does matter to everybody, but I also think that people's views on the law are shaped by all sorts of things. And also, one issue, I mean, the key question really is going to be, you know, stare decisis. And stare decisis is a pretty kind of squishy inquiry that seems to involve a certain amount of policy judgments. And
has Justice Gorsuch voted for any stare decisis result since he's been on the court? I'm not sure he has. I mean, there are cases he decided not to return, but I'm not sure there are any cases that he said are wrong that shouldn't be overturned.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that hasn't happened.
No. I mean, at some point I was trying to come out of a list, and he was the one I couldn't, but I may have missed one, or one may have happened since.
Where was he in that? You remember that tax case from a few years ago? You know what I'm talking about? Or the Wayfair?
Wayfair? Was he on the court yet?
I thought that was right after he got there, but maybe not. Maybe that was pre. That was after him. Where was he on that? I'm looking that up. He was joined the majority that overturned precedent.
There you go.
So yeah. So he may not be.
Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say he may not be a big fan of retaining precedents with which he disagrees in the same way that Justice Thomas is not.
Right. So I think Justice Barrett is the, you know, as a prediction matter, the person with whose vote I think would be the most, or whose reasoning would be the most unclear, whether she'd be open to something like what the Chief Justice suggests, that they shouldn't, you know, unnecessarily decide with an overall precedent if there are other things, you know, other narrower grounds, or that she'll find those narrower grounds, you know, unavailing or inappropriate. But I don't really have any insight into what she's likely to do, which is part of why I haven't pressured you to record an episode about Dobbs.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like we've talked a lot about the abortion cases heading in. And I don't know if we had much to say that was super insightful, that would add a lot to, you know, all the people that are commenting on it. But yeah, with the kind of wrap up that point about Justice Barrett, I thought she was a little bit harder to read at the oral argument. You know, she has sometimes indicated that, you know, maybe we don't have to avoid overrule precedent if we don't really need to. You know, I think that if you were making a prediction kind of ex ante, just based on her like biography, you know, I think a lot of people sort of assume she's going to be super gung-ho to overrule. And if there are four votes there, I guess I'm not super confident. I'm pretty that she would be the lone holdout. I was more willing to believe there would be kind of like a Roberts, Barrett, Kavanaugh kind of constellation that might adopt sort of an intermediate position, and at least the Kavanaugh part of that. I don't see that based on the argument. I mean, people, they can always surprise you, but
yeah, that all seems right.
So if that happens, I would say that the political focus on the court, which has been high for the last few years, is going to intensify by, you know, a factor of 10 or 100. I mean, this is just going to be a really, really big deal. And it's going to be something that's going to be all over the elections, even more than the court has been. And so buckle up.
I'm less sure that's true, by the way. I mean,
yeah, say more.
I don't know. I mean, obviously it'll be all over lawyers and law professors and people steeped in sort of the Supreme Court. But for regular people, I don't have a good sense of when the Supreme Court becomes a top agenda item, and when it inflation and systemic racism and other things are more important. And I don't know.
Yeah. So let me just offer a couple thoughts on that. So first of all, I think some people are just assuming that if this happens, it's the number one issue and it helps Democrats across the board. And that might be Democrats being overconfident. It may actually be less politically impactful than people think. But I do think this is the kind of issue that the public can grasp, right? This is not like cases like Shelby County that are about, you know, complicated issues of federal statutes and structural constitutional provisions, right? And like this is like going to be summed up. I mean, first of all, people, you know, a lot of people know what haven't read Roe versus Wade, but they know what it means. And they know like what abortion is, and they have views about that. And they're going to, the headline will be Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade and makes abortion legal, right? Like people can understand that. I mean, not saying it's going to necessarily change the outcomes of all the elections, but I do think it's going to be very, 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 very high profile.
Certainly high profile. I mean, people can understand anything. I'm not sure everybody understands what set of abortion regulations are currently unconstitutional under Roe and what aren't. I think you can ask questions that get to the different answers to that question. And I'm not sure everybody will understand that your ability to get an abortion in many states will not change whether the Supreme Court does in Dobbs, because many states will not avail themselves of the new power the Supreme Court gives them, and then other states will. So, and I'm not even sure I know what will actually happen, like what the decision will really mean in a real world sense if it happens.
Yeah, although, I mean, if they say there is no constitutional right to an abortion, Roe versus Wade is wrong, then presumably a total ban that a state would want to enact would be permissible. And I think right.
people, we just people don't know how many states either will enact them, or if you've already enacted one, does it take effect?
Yeah, I'd say more than zero. I mean, a lot of states have these trigger laws.
Are those going to be upheld or not? I don't know. I think there'll have to be a follow-on case to see whether those are treated as valid.
What would be the basis for not for overturning them?
You'd say that some principle of anti-retroactivity or judicial supremacy or something means that the state has to pass a sort of a free and clear choice. Sort of, you know, we do the same thing for administrative agencies. Sometimes we say if they make a,
Yeah, I guess they could make up a new principle, but that doesn't sound super likely to me either. I mean, sure, there's going to be follow-up questions, but like the thing that they would do could be summarized, I think, quite briefly and quickly. And I think that's what people focus on. It's like they know the court said, you know, there's a constitutional right to gay marriage. They don't know the details. They surely haven't read the opinion, right? They just know those big picture things, even if it doesn't resolve the question, which is actually kind of why I sort of always thought that the strategy for conservatives, the ones that are inclined to being more pragmatic and maybe less, you know, principled, would be to chip away at Roe, but never actually say you're overturning it, right? Because then you get the outcomes, but you know, you don't get the quite as much of the public scrutiny and people just being able to say they're overturning Roe. You know, it did seem like maybe that was sort of what was going to happen with the Texas law, but I mean, the court, you know, court got a lot of attention when it refused to step in there initially, and it seems like maybe they noticed how much attention that got. I just think it's going to be, yeah, obviously, it's an issue that's going to affect a lot of people. I think I'm certainly not, don't share your uncertainty about like whether it's going to change facts on the ground. I think it will change facts on the ground quite significantly in ways that affect people's lives, but I think that it's going to change the public conversation about the court in a way that, you know, going well beyond, you know, what's been happening since then. You know, maybe for, you know, from some perspectives for the better, maybe for the worse, but it's going to be a thing.
Yeah. Well, depends what happens. We'll see.
I think that that's one where I would anticipate we are going to be waiting quite some time for the decision there, because it's going to, if they actually are overturning, and even if they're not overturning, but just upholding the law, I mean, there's going to be dissents. People are going to want to write separately. And so I'm anticipating, you know, late June, July, you know, at, you know, yeah. Hard to imagine them getting it out of the way earlier.
Agreed.
Okay. That's actually not the main topic of our episode today. We wanted to talk about something we've actually been dying to talk about for months, you know, probably since we first, shortly after we first formed this podcast, right? But we have been unable to do so.
Well, I've been unable, and you've been very patiently waiting for my gag order to end.
I can't talk about it with myself on the, you know, just do monologue.
You could
stand there mute. I mean, I could.
You could have usurped the podcast.
Yeah, I could have just released an episode. But what's that? What's our topic?
Supreme Court reform, and in particular, the institution, the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States, that has spent the past a little more than 180 days deliberating over whether the Supreme Court is broken and how it needs to be fixed.
Yeah, although even is that actually what was being the question that was put before the commission? So we have this commission. Let's give people the background. We have this commission. Where does it come from? So Biden, as people may know, there was a lot of upset on the left and the Democratic side about what's happened with the court in the last few years. You have Republican Senate refuses to confirm Garland, keeps the seat open. Gorsuch is confirmed. You have the very contentious Kavanaugh nomination. And then you have Republicans confirming Barrett, I think 8 days before the election, you know, basically hypocritically violating the earlier statement that you have to let the next president, the nominee. So basically the perception is Republicans have gotten control of the court through underhanded tactics. So a lot of people on the left are calling for various forms of court reform, court packing, just add more justices, retaliatory justices. I have done some work with Ganesh Sitaraman where we proposed other kinds of reforms that were aimed sort of more at kind of like, is there some way we can design a Supreme Court that wouldn't produce this kind of retaliatory, you know, political capture? And Mayor Pete Buttigieg picked up one of those proposals, our proposal for a balanced bench with kind of an ideologically balanced court where there would be some justices from the lower court sitting by designation. That got to be part of the conversation during the Democratic primary. And I think Mayor Pete really, really made that topic a bigger topic during the Democratic primary. And so Biden was being asked about it, and then he got asked about it, continued to be asked about whether he supported court packing during the general election. He said he tried out various things of how to answer the question, because I think he didn't want to say, so I think he doesn't support it, but I think he didn't want to say no, because then he maybe turns off the engaged Democratic base. But he certainly didn't want to say yes, because then, you know, he fears that, you know, freaks out the sort of moderate, you know, possible suburban Republicans who might vote for him. And so the first answer he tried out was, I'll give you my answer after the election.
Which I found admirable, but
I did. Fly. It as a marketing strategy, I think it was not super persuasive to people. And then he finally came up with a strategy that I think was a little smarter. And that was the creation of this commission. We have the clip where he, you know, discusses the plan. And so let's play that clip briefly.
If elected, what I will do is I'll put together a national commission of bipartisan commission of scholars, constitutional scholars, Democrats, Republicans, liberal, conservative. And I will ask them to, over 180 days, come back to me with recommendations as to how to reform the court system, because it's getting out of whack, the way in which it's being handled. And it's not about court packing. There's a number of other things that our constitutional scholars have debated, and I'd look to see what recommendations that commission might make.
Okay. And then that was in the run-up to the election. He's elected, doesn't really do anything with the commission on day one. It takes him, I don't know, what, like 3 months?
April 9th is the official announcement, okay. Although I was contacted, I think, during the transition. So they were working on the commission.
But the executive order went out like several April months, 9th. Like in April. Right. Yeah.
Yes. But we were told it's about to happen. It's about to happen. Okay. Here we go.
And so commission is formed.
I guess we should tell people in case they don't know. So I was on the commission. I was one of the commissioners. You were one of the people who testified in front of the commission telling us what we should do. So we both had a strong, you know, eye on the process.
Yeah. You were the insider. I was the outsider lobbing stones at the commission. But yes, I did testify. That was interesting. It was on Zoom. So it was not quite as thrilling as it would have been in a world where, I don't know, you would have been set up in like, I don't know, like a room in the Senate or something. I don't have no idea where they would do that.
Yeah, some random federal building, I think. Yeah. It was a presidential commission, so not the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, we did everything on Zoom. We did everything on Zoom.
Yeah, it was a Zoom. which honestly sounds pretty tedious to me. But like, okay, so like, let's just read the charge in the executive order of what you were asked to do. I'm going to pull that up. This is executive order 14023, executive order on the establishment of the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States. It establishes the commission. Says members shall be distinguished constitutional scholars. There you go, Will. Retired members of the federal judiciary or other individuals having experience with and knowledge of the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court of the United States.
So that maintains ambiguity. I might be a distinguished constitutional scholar, or I might be an undistinguished constitutional scholar, but another individual.
Yeah, you can't be both, right? It's like a or. It's not.
Well, it could be an inclusive or.
Yeah, it could be. And then it helpfully gives us the parenthetical indicating that they're going to summarize, they're going to refer to Supreme Court of the United States as Supreme Court in the remainder of the executive order. Very official. Two co-chairs, and then the commission is asked to produce a report that includes an account of the contemporary commentary and debate about the role and operation of the Supreme Court in our constitutional system, and about the functioning of the constitutional process by which the president nominates, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, appoints justices of the Supreme Court, and then also the historical background of other periods in the nation's history when the Supreme Court's role in the nominations and advice and consent process were subject to critical assessment and prompted proposals for reform. Okay, so like a kind of a big like book report kind of summary.
How did we get
encyclopedia
here?
Entry. And also an analysis of the principal arguments in the contemporary public debate for and against Supreme Court reform, including an appraisal of the merits and legality of particular reform proposals.
That's right.
So produce report, lots of background, and then an analysis of arguments and an appraisal of the merits and legality of particular reform proposals.
Well, and so this week we ended up producing and officially voting to submit to the president a 294-page document, that may be more than he bargained for, that has five chapters. One is the history of reform. Second is court packing, although it's called membership and size of the court, a little gentler. Chapter three is term limits. Chapter four is the court's role in the constitutional system, which is mostly a reference to things like jurisdiction stripping, other attempts to have the court be sort of more deferential to the legislative process. And then five, the Supreme Court's procedures and practices, which means the shadow docket and judicial ethics and cameras in the court.
And we're going to get into the substance, but, you know, mostly it's impressive. I think it's impressive that this commission actually was able to produce a document of this length and get everybody to vote for it, sort of, which we'll get to in a second. But let's talk about the membership and then sort of how the work proceeded. And then we can get into the substance. So the membership, I think there were 36 commissioners originally.
Well, 36 at first, and then we lost a couple along the way.
Yeah, 36, which is a lot, right? It's a big commission. It's not a size that you want if you want like kind of a nimble kind of group. I mean, it's a really big group. I mean, it's like the size of my faculty at my school, or, you know.
Yeah, mine too. You know,
kind of, yeah, hard to do stuff. It was, I'd say, almost all law professors. A couple judges, former judges.
Political scientist.
Yeah, one political scientist.
And the heads of several public interest organizations, the Brennan Center, the NAACP.
But it was, I think, heavily tilted towards, like, it was kind of like, if you look at it, it's kind of like, here's who we might invite to, like, a very prestigious symposium on, like, the Supreme Court that's going to be held at, or something like that, right? Very kind of elite law professors who kind of like teach con law or kind of do stuff that's adjacent to that. It's not really people who had written about and certainly not really endorsed court reform previously, you know, of which there are a lot in the academy. And so, and actually I think, well, you might be one of the people who'd written the most about court reform heading into this, right? Because you at least wrote that, you wrote a blog post last year about like, you know, maybe term limits, you know, might make sense just because they'll make people happy.
I had a couple blog posts. I think, so Keith Whittington, I think, has written quite a bit about the history of debates about court packing. I think Tara Grove had written quite a bit. So there were a few people who'd written a non-trivial amount. But yes, mostly, you know, two law school deans, mostly people who were in the general constitutional law, constitutional interpretation area, but were not necessarily focused on court packing, term limits, you know, pro or con.
Yeah. And tilted towards, I think, the very elite end. I mean, so the kinds of folks who write lots of recommendation letters to send their students to clerk onto the court. And so, you know, one criticism that was aired pretty publicly after the membership was announced was, it's too elite, it's too many law professors, and it doesn't have people that are going to be really fired up in favor of reform, right? It's hard for me to kind of take that on too clearly because, you know, I think it would have been fun to be on the commission as somebody who had written a ton about court reform, about term limits, or about other stuff. But on the other hand, given, you know, given what the commission was being asked to do, which was kind of analyze and report, it would be kind of hard to have people on it who, you know, had their own proposals. And I can understand that. And it seems to me like, you know, the criticism, you know, is, you know, kind of more aimed at like the charge, right, of what was being asked to do. Is that this, as I read the charge, I mean, the commission was not really being asked to do something dramatic. It was kind of being asked to do, you know, a really, really detailed kind of report.
The report certainly concluded that ultimately it was not the report's place to offer a list of recommendations, you know, here's our proposed bill or our proposed constitutional amendment. You could have read the charge, you know, and appraisal of the merits and legality in different ways, right? One way to appraise the merits of proposals is to say, here is what should be done and analyze all proposals relative to that, but that's not what it did. And again, with 34 law professors from varied backgrounds, maybe that's sort of built into the setup.
Yeah. And sort of less in the way of, you know, people who are, you know, part of like political action groups who are like pushing for immediate change. And one criticism that I think is pretty well placed is it did strike me as too many law professors. I say this as a law professor, too many law professors relative to, you could have had more political scientists. I mean, there's a lot of political scientists who, you know, study the court, study judicial behavior, study public opinion on the court. And I think the marginal value add of a few more people like that versus, you know, 26th or 27th law professor might have been good. Not a lot of historians. I think your colleague, Allison Acroy, is she the only?
There are so many on the commission. Maybe. I always forget who's on the commission, but not a lot of historians.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I will say, totally agree. Somebody else should have had my seat for sure. I do think, you know, the funny thing about law professors, as you know, is that law so voraciously consumes other methodologies. Lots of the law professors on this group have written extensively about constitutional history or participate and write in the sort of political science literature. I think law professors often overestimate, you know, our ability to mimic political science professors and historians and other, you know, methodologies. So I'm with you that probably some people who had a different set of methodological skills could have been useful, could have made this a much better larger symposium anyway. But there are quite a few people on this panel who do, you know, empirical work about the Supreme Court and things like that, I think, too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's certainly fair. You know, I'm a law professor who's done some work like that, but it seemed like there were like broader representation of different kinds of sources of inquiry might have been useful, you know, given that just it had the feel of, you know, hey, you know, let's just invite, you know, our friends at Harvard and Yale to be on the commission.
Well, I do think there's another interesting, I was not privy at all to the conversations about who to invite to be on it, and I don't know why they asked me, but
I think you know why they asked you. Well, it's a bipartisan commission, right? And, you know, there were some prominent conservatives asked to be on the commission, right?
Well, right. So I was going to say, it was bipartisan, more like the way a law school is bipartisan, not the way Congress is bipartisan. You have a couple of token conservatives, none of whom actually voted for Trump, and that counts, but that's okay. So there were a range of different political backgrounds or ideologies. There was, I think it was quite racially diverse. It was an effort to make sure it was relatively gender diverse. There are some big names, so if they're not on the commission, it'd be odd, like Larry Tribe. And once you sort of add up all the different things you're trying to do, you know, you end up with 34 people and they're all law professors already. So I do sort of see how that happens.
Yeah, it's 34 or 36.
Yeah.
So yes, on that note, I think it was the commission was largely, you know, full of liberals. I think, you know, less in the way of kind of people I would describe as like true kind of left. I don't want to characterize everybody on there, but I think, you know, the bulk of the folks I would characterize as kind of like traditional, you know, liberals.
Liberal rather than progressive or something.
Maybe that's the better word. Not progressive. And then some folks who are, seen as conservative. So you, obviously, former Judge Griffith of the D.C. Circuit, a Republican appointee. I don't know if Judge David Levy, you know, former dean of Duke Law School, former federal judge, is considered a conservative. I think he is a Republican appointee. George Mason's, Adam White. But then a couple people, conservative folks who quit, which is interesting. And I don't have any special insight, but those two are Harvard's Jack Goldsmith and Virginia's Caleb Nelson. And they were on the commission at the beginning. They were not on it at the end. They haven't really said why, but presumably they didn't agree with what the commission was putting in their report or was going to put in their report, or they just found the meetings really tedious, which I would have. But so, you didn't quit. Yeah. You didn't quit, Will.
Yeah. So I don't feel like I can speak to why they quit if they're not going to speak about it. But I will say I thought seriously about quitting around the same time, which is around the time that we as members of the commission were first able to read the report we've been writing. Because as a consequence of the federal transparency rules, it was very difficult for documents or anything like that to circulate among the commission as a whole, because then that would be a deliberation, which would then have to take place in public. So it was quite late in the day that we sort of really sat together as a commission to first deliberate about the full draft.
And because it was kind of split up into subcommittees and stuff where, you know, people were writing parts of it. And then
if working groups are studying a particular issue and writing materials about that issue, then that's not a commission deliberation. But once you have a full document circulating to the full commission, you know, then that's more like deliberations that has to be public. And, you know, when that happens,
federal suddenly, bureaucracy.
But I will say that's actually the biggest learning experience I've had about this whole thing was the federal bureaucracy.
You're gonna that's your next article, right? You're gonna like do the original meaning of like the Federal Commissions Act or whatever.
The case against FACA. I'd worked for the federal government for 2 years as a law clerk, so I sort of thought I knew what like federal bureaucracy was like, but I think I had not appreciated how much health more streamlined the federal judiciary is, as cumbersome as we think about it, compared to a lot of the things that have to happen.
Yeah. You said you considered, you saw the documents, and then you were like, what was the thought process?
Well, I guess the thought process was, at this point, I had taken an oath. I had a commission, like an actual commission, you know, Marbury versus Madison commission to hang on my wall.
Would you have to send that back if you quit?
I thought about that.
Is it actually on your wall? Is it on your wall?
So it is leaning against the wall. It is framed and leaning against the wall.
But did they frame it or did you pay to frame it?
I paid to frame it.
You paid to frame it, but then didn't bother to put it on the wall.
The law school facilities people have to be the one to hang things on my wall.
Oh, so. Okay. Yeah, we have that. We have that too. Yeah.
And I just haven't called them yet. They will.
But you had the wherewithal to frame it. Have you gotten admitted to the Supreme Court bar?
No. I have until the end of the season, don't I?
I mean, you have nothing. You should have done it 10 years ago. But yeah, I mean, sure.
I wasn't eligible.
Do whatever you want.
I guess I was.
You've been eligible for a while.
10 years, almost exactly 10 years, I guess. It doesn't matter. Anyway, but I guess I thought to myself, you know, the question is not at this point, like, do I agree with this document? The question is, will I be doing more good by staying around at the meetings and trying to talk to people and, you know, trying to push the document in a direction I think it should go? And I decided, for better or worse, that you know, it'd be helpful to stay part of the conversations.
And so in terms of the document that was ultimately produced, the final report, it honestly doesn't take a lot of substantive positions on stuff. It a lot of it is kind of, you know, exposition, giving background, you know, and it's quite useful in that regard. Like I'm going to rely on this and cite it. Anytime I write anything about court reform in the future, it's got just like, you know, it's a really thorough discussion of history and various instances where, you know, people have proposed different kinds of court reform. But it's a lot, and then it, you know, talks about kind of pros and cons of various reforms. It's a lot lighter on kind of like bottom line conclusions about, you know, like we should definitely do this or not do that. And I read the draft ones at the time, you know, maybe they were a little bit have more tilted towards recommendations, but even those were not super heavy-handed and taking positions.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I will say, so I'll note, you know, two other different kinds of reports you could imagine, or you could imagine a much shorter report, like a 16-page report designed to actually be, you know, widely read. That's just like bottom line conclusions. Like, it's like you've called together 34 law professors and we all agree the Supreme Court has gone too far and the time has come to add 4 justices. And we hate to say it, but you know, it's like, you know, it's time to break the glass, or the opposite. You know, all of us agree that it would be premature to pack the court at a minimum. We have different views about when it would no longer be premature, but we're not there. You can imagine a document more like that, like a kind of position statement that obviously is not what the commission produced. And you can also imagine one that decided to lean in more to our legal expertise, that just like made firm conclusions about the legality of all the proposals. You know, here is why court packing is constitutional. Here's the deal with term limits and whether or not you can do these various, you know, big debate that you've taken part in about whether you can effectively limit Supreme Court justices' terms without technically limiting their terms so as to comply with the Constitution. You can imagine one that's sort of like all in on law and then says, you know, about the policy, we don't, you know, we leave that to politics or something. And the commission did not produce any of those options.
Yeah. And it seems like to me, like both of those options were unrealistic to expect given the kind of size and diversity of the commission's membership, right? I can't imagine that like every single person on the commission has the same view about the constitutionality of the various reform proposals.
Apparently not. The report does take a firm position that court packing is lawful. It does not explain why, but it does conclude that the arguments that it is unlawful are wrong.
Yeah, it's sort of, if I'm thinking about the same part that you're talking about, it sort of references Georgetown professor Randy Barnett's testimony before the commission, where he argued that partisan court packing is unconstitutional, finding some support for this, claim support for this in his version of originalism. Wasn't totally clear to me whether he was actually making that argument with a straight face or not. But yeah, the report does sort of poo-poo that argument.
But yeah, you can imagine saying it's wrong because I'm an originalist, and at the founding there was, you know, much more court packing than we see today. A living constitutionalist might have to have a different explanation, because they might normally rely on 150 years of practice to produce a constitutional norm, and they'd have to have some different explanation. You could also imagine people thinking, actually, partisan court packing might be something that really was just partisan court packing. It might be unconstitutional, but that what people are proposing is not really partisan, because it's, you know, designed to save the country from evil or.
Yeah. Whatever. I mean, it is challenging, though, to distinguish what's partisan and what isn't. I mean, given that, you know, many things that legislatures do, you know, they're doing to effectuate their preferred policies.
And like, yeah, I that's absolutely right. And I think one interesting irony, right? So another way you could have resolved this was to say, well, it's challenging to determine what's partisan. That's why the Supreme Court has concluded that partisan gerrymandering is non-justiciable and, you know, chosen to stay out of that. And we should draw the same lesson here, that for the same reason, you know, partisan gerrymandering of the Supreme Court would be effectively fine or non-justiciable. But the Supreme Court's decision about that is very controversial, including among some of the same people who support court packing. So it's just complicated to get the story straight, I think.
Yeah. In my testimony before the commission, you know, you speak for just a few minutes and, you know, you get a couple of questions, but you also have the opportunity to submit written testimony. And in my written testimony, I said various things. One of the things I tried to do was sort of how, you know, this is a bipartisan commission. Can I try to make an argument for our system being broken in a way that doesn't just sort of appeal to people's partisan inclinations? You know, I think that's really hard. You know, I tried to do my best partially just to kind of work the argument out and then talk about, you know, different strategies for how those problems that I identify, which I sort of try to frame as, you know, structural problems. It's like you've got this really powerful institution. The way the membership is chosen is like semi-random, subject to manipulation, and it's ultimately in a world where, you know, politics and law are both very polarized, it's going to kind of lead to crisis like we're seeing now. But I close by sort of saying, look, you know, the main thing I think would be really good to do is not do something, like try to not, you know, come up with a consensus, you know, claimed consensus that a bunch of things are impermissible, that are unconstitutional. I feel like that is where the commission is much more likely to be persuasive than anywhere else. Like if the commission writes this, you know, this Democratic commission had written this report, you know, that said, you know, we think court packing is unconstitutional, that's then, you know, held out as a cudgel, you know, by, you know, Republicans, say, if Democrats try to do it in 5 years or 10 years. And so my admonition was, you know, like, try to not take anything off the table. Don't do any harm.
Do we do okay on that score?
I think so. I thought that, they do evaluate the constitutionality of various proposals, and you know, they don't love the constitutionality of Maya and Ganesha's proposals, which is fine, because when we proposed them, we specifically sort of said, look, these are adventurous constitutional arguments, and our goal isn't actually to sort of make slam dunk arguments, but to sort of say, let's think creatively. You know, they left some things on the table. I think the report says, you know, maybe panels would be okay. That doesn't necessarily, you know, some people have said you can't have a Supreme Court that sits in panels because the Constitution says there should be one Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was kind of a dumb argument. And the commission report seems to sort of say, yeah, that's not totally persuasive. So I thought it was good.
I don't think we say it's unpersuasive. I think we just take a position. I don't think we say it's unpersuasive. I think we just don't take a position on it, I think.
Well, I read the report as sort of like treating, maybe not conclusively ruling it out, but maybe sort of saying, we don't, you know, we don't think that, I read the report as saying, like, we don't buy this argument completely, or like, we don't, like, you know, this is an argument, but like, there's a lot of counter arguments to it.
I think so. There's a passage where we say the commission is not prepared, however, to conclude their rotation and panel systems are clearly unconstitutional simply on the ground that each would entail. And I will say, I think there are individual commissioners who were prepared to make that conclusion.
Oh, I'm sure.
So I think this reflects just a lack of consensus on the commission, not a consensus that the argument's bad.
No, that's fair. But I'm just saying, the point is, this report now cannot be used to try to take that off the table, is my point.
Right. Just different from the commission, the report seems to say something slightly stronger about court packing.
Yes, it's not fair. Just,
yeah.
But I always thought that the report saying something is permissible is not necessarily is certainly not going to be the last word on anything. The commission saying something Democrats want to do down the road is unconstitutional is harder. I mean, an example of that being that, like, a big talking point that emerged during, you know, there was a political debate about court packing in the run up to the 2020 election that kind of got derailed by the way the Senate broke down. But a lot of people were sort of passing around the, you know, it was a 1937 Senate Judiciary Committee report saying that, like, court packing is unconstitutional. And this was, like, majority Democrat commission, and that was kind of being used as a look. They thought it was unconstitutional. So I don't think that they did anything here that's really going to be super damning, super problematic. If people, you know, want to pursue more kind of adventurous reforms, like, there's in Congress, some people in Congress have put forward statutory term limits proposals. You know, this report is not big on those, I would say, but I just think that those kinds of conversations should play out a bit more in the, you know, political arena and not be short-circuited by, you know, this kind of effort.
Yeah. I think it's unfortunate that, again, the Commission of Law Professors, so our main expertise is law, couldn't come to consensus on even basic questions like, do term limits have to be done by statute or by the Constitution? When I talked to some political scientists, actually, about, like, is there anything useful this report could actually do to contribute to the conversation? One of the answers I got was, the most useful thing you could do would just be to give us a clear answer about whether this could be done by statute or by the Constitution. And some of them had not the opposite of your view, like, be fine if the clear answer is you need a constitutional amendment and we won't waste our time. Imagine spending a ton of political capital to get through a statutory term limits proposal, only to then have it be held unconstitutional anyway. So I think it's unfortunate
I guess
it can't.
My view is that, like, this report could not conclusively foreclose, like, could not like make a predictive determination about what would happen, right? Like, it's a hard question, right? It's a hard question. It depends a lot on your theory of constitutional interpretation, and, like, how it is answered. Like, I think it depends a lot on what's happening in the country at the time. And just realistically, I don't think this is math, right? I don't think you can just, I think there are some, you know, yeah, there are some easy constitutional questions. I think there are a bunch that are not, like, you can't just, like, break it all down and then just get the, like, you know, the answer and then it's resolved for all time. You've got the proof, you know, the proof.
I agree. Law is not math. Probably better at law than I was at math, but at the same time, I guess when I say it's unfortunate, it's unfortunate that these legal questions are some of the ones on which it is unclear, and the unclarity seems to be caught up in our polarization. It would be better if somehow either the constitutional text were clearer or our ability to find consensus was different, because you might have thought.
But I don't think that this is a unique problem for, like, the good behavior clause, right? I think that of the questions that we care most deeply about are ones where constitutional text is vague, other sources are deeply indeterminate, the question has never been firmly answered. It depends a lot on what you think constitutional law is and how it should work. I mean, there's just a lot of things.
Although there are times, so there seems to be a widespread bipartisan, in my view, deeply mistaken, but bipartisan agreement that the U.S. Supreme Court gets the last word on most constitutional questions, for instance. And that's an example that may be good in some ways, that we all have, you know, have managed to reach consensus on that, even if we then you know, fight a lot of what the Supreme Court should do. And one of the things people said a lot during the commission meetings about the commission, like one of the things this commission might accomplish is show that you can bring together a bunch of people who have different views of the world and show that they can still, you know, make some progress or reach some consensus and show that that's possible in our sort of deeply polarized world. And I guess I'm just, I wish we'd done them more of that.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that a lot. And actually, that's, I feel like that's kind of the motivation for this podcast, right? Like, is that we are in a, I feel like we are in a moment in political and legal time where polarization is very high, and it strikes me as extremely threatening, in the sense that in a world where all, basically all legal questions are just seen as kind of like a Democrat, or there's a Democrat answer and a Republican answer, I just, it's very hard to understand how you can have, you know, what we call a rule of law in that sense. You just have people picking sides. And so trying to kind of preserve, and this is something I talk about a little bit in my written testimony, trying to preserve some sort of area, common ground, is really critical, even though it's very challenging. And even though there's a lot of reasons why, you know, people on the left like don't want to preserve common ground. They're very, and I think rightfully unhappy about the, you know, the political chicanery that led to where we are. There's lots of, really on both sides, I think there's a lot of, you know, feeling that the other side is acting in bad faith. But we do need to have some core, I think, of like what we agree on as like is a correct legal answer to some things. Because otherwise, I think everything kind of falls apart.
I'll say, at the risk of self-aggrandizement, I think we are more successful at that mission sometimes in this podcast than maybe the commission was.
And well, there's only two of us.
Well, that is this question is, you know, if you can do it at two and you can't necessarily always do it at 34, you know, what's the number? 9, more or less.
Yeah. But it may be that, you know, we just have, in some areas, we have views that overlap. I think we're both, you know, we have slightly different, you know, policy legal views for sure, but like we're not like hardliners with respect to our own ideologies and legal views. Maybe you're a hardliner, your legal views. I'm not sure what my position is on that.
I don't quite know what that would mean, but
I don't either. But it also depends on like what kind of conversation you're having. Like if you're having a question about like, we know who's on the Supreme Court and we know the legal materials and like we, you know, what's the answer in this case? Like it's kind of like a prediction, right? Versus like, you know, what is the platonically the best answer? That might be a different question.
Right. And it's tough because I think Congress and the president are often sort of doing both. I mean, obviously, you don't want to pass legislation that you can confidently predict will be struck down by the Supreme Court, although occasionally you might do that, you know, to prove a point. But then also some members of Congress sort of care about the Constitution, some platonic ideal of the Constitution, and there might be things the Supreme Court would tell them they could do that they would say, no, my understanding of the Constitution doesn't let me do that. And that'd be different. So can I run a few specific ideas by you that didn't make it into the report just to talk about the merits a little bit?
Yep.
Okay. So here are a few reform proposals that it seems to me that I've come to think would be good. I'll put them together, you two, as a package, because I don't think you'll, well, I don't know. Here's what you think. On the size of the court, I think at this point, it would be a good idea to have a constitutional amendment fixing the size of the Supreme Court at 9, so as to eliminate the fear of each party that the other party will pack the court as soon as they get a chance. Now, obviously, we might later learn 9 is the wrong number and need more, but if we ever had like a true bipartisan need for a different number, we could always amend the Constitution to have a different number. So I think at this point, it'd be safest to just fix it at 9. On confirmation process, I think we should reinstate the supermajority requirement for confirmation by constitutional amendment, not rely on the filibuster. I'm open to what the number should be, but 2/3 or something seems good to me. And thus that will force presidents to compromise, to pick people who can get, I mean, I guess you could always try as the minority party just to confirm nobody and hope nobody blames you for that. But the usual record of shutdown says that doesn't work very well. And we should make constitutional amendments easier because a huge amount of the, like you can't solve the Supreme Court problem without solving the problem of the stakes of the Supreme Court. And one of the reasons that we all care so much about the Supreme Court's constitutional law decisions is because we think amendments are de facto impossible. And so we should just make the amendment process much easier. And if we do those three things together, we'd have a much better system.
Okay, super interesting. Let me tackle those one by one. So fixing the court at 9, if that's the only thing we're going to do, I don't love that. I think your view of that depends a little bit on your view on like how much do we trust courts versus want to have like democratic political input on the system. I do think that having the cudgel of court packing is useful for keeping the court maybe a little bit more majoritarian. And I do not love the idea of just saying we have nine, and even if got those nine in a way that seems like deeply problematic, we're just stuck with them, right? Like, and there's nothing the democratic process can do about that. I don't know. I think having some of these tools, even if they're never used, probably better if they're never used, just in the background, you know, like court packing, like jurisdiction stripping as potential threats is good. And so I don't love that. I don't love that one. I could see pairing it with a term limits amendment. I could see that. I could see the case.
You sort of, I think term limits amendments almost all have to also include the number, because otherwise the term limits don't.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the kind of term limits proposal. I mean, I think if you have a statutory term limits proposal, you don't have to have a,
right.
You don't have to but fix it.
You have a constitutional amendment setting up 18-year terms. The assumption is that's because there are nine justices. It's every 2 years.
And yeah. But, you know, I just don't love that, because I can imagine, you know, like what if like four justices die in a plane crash and like, you know, Trump puts four crazy people on, you know, like, I mean, there's just a lot of scenarios you can come up with, right? I just don't like the idea. Like part of my objection to the current set of affairs is like, this is a really small group of people and they exercise a huge amount of power for a really long period of time. And their membership is like semi-random and like only kind of like bears a partial, you know, connection to the results of elections. And like, I think that kind of makes it worse to me.
I'm not convinced impeachment should be as off the table as it is, by the way. I mean, so the one, you know, one interesting thing, but that wouldn't solve all the problems.
Yeah. We, I mean, you'd have to impeach, really change the.
We can't impeach actual bad people now. So
rules there. So supermajority, very interesting. I think it maybe almost like confuses symptom for disease in the sense that the problem with the current, you know, it's sort of the political Supreme Court nominations have gotten increasingly polarized and contentious, and we eliminate the filibuster and now it's party line. But I don't think that that's happening because we've eliminated supermajority requirements. I think that's happening because our politics is more polarized and our legal culture is more polarized. And a lot of our nomination battles are proxy fights about other things, proxy fights about abortion. And so in a world where we increasingly have these two, you know, just totally opposed schools of, you know, constitutional interpretation, and like the stakes are so high. Like, I don't know. Does anybody get 60 votes? Maybe Congress cooperates about other things, but maybe you just have much longer periods where no one can be confirmed. I mean, I think that having a supermajority requirement for other things in the Senate has not obviously been a great thing from my perspective. And so, I don't know, would that be better? You know, maybe there's a lot of like, I don't know.
A big question kind of,
you know, types that you could.
Exactly. I think the big question is there a set of nominees who were currently not even, you know, we now think of as unconfirmable, who would be great, you know, who are, maybe they are conservatives who are very differential on, like, they are in conservatives, like Frank Easterbrook. Maybe they're just really old. Maybe they're like, you know, incredibly well-respected intellectually, but a little bit, you know, unpredictable politically, like former Judge Richard Posner. You know, we'd have to think about in that space who those people might be. And you're right. It might be that at this point, what we would actually get is nine empty seats. Although, you know, Sam Moyne and some other witnesses for the commission might think that was an improvement too.
Yeah. So. Well, let me tell you what I do like about that, though. I do like the motivation underlying it. Like, let's try to find this center. And that is – so one of the features of the balanced bench proposal that Mayor Pete picked up was, you know, you've got the kind of these like two groups of partisan justices. They're kind of slotted to political party, which is actually not as crazy as it sounds. That's how – there's informal arrangements like that in constitutional courts in other countries. But then you would pick – five more justices as by designation, they would sit with the court, you know, the way that, you know, Court of Appeals judges do with district judges. But they would have to kind of unanimously approve the slate. And the idea there was something similar. It's like maybe there are these kind of moderate types, like you suggested. I don't know if Posner's the right call because he's just so wacky. But people that are kind of respected but are not not seen as, you know, true partisans. I mean, the counter argument, and maybe this applies more to your suggestion than to mine, is that, you know, what it ends up selecting for is the Kagan-Roberts type, who are both great, but who both very studiously avoided taking positions publicly. And it was like really hard to know what they thought, which I get, but I don't love. You know, I actually have a lot more respect for people that are willing to kind of say what they think. I mean, that's what I've always done in my career, and certainly what seems to be what you do. And I, you know, I don't love a process that seems to select for people that like lack that kind of civic courage.
Yeah. I'm not sure I would accuse either Justice Kagan or the Chief Justice of lacking civic courage, but I agree that neither you nor I would be likely to be confirmed under this kind of regime. But that might be. I mean, yeah,
also possibly any other.
But. Fair enough. I mean, my favorite justices would not succeed under this regime. So it's, you know, it's not. I don't think
Justice Scalia got like, you know, almost unanimous approval. So
that's true. That's true.
But that was a different time. Third one, make constitutional amendments easier. Yeah, that's super interesting. Again, I don't know if that's good or bad in a world of polarization. One thing is, as a Democrat, I'm not going to love that because the way, you know, voters are distributed, Republicans and have a big advantage in control of state governments.
Right. Although typically, we could do it lots of ways. We could do national referendum, 65% voting rule or something.
Yeah, I like that. I'm generally more in favor of stuff like that. It has led to good results in my home state. You know, there's stuff that the legislature won't put through, but it's actually broadly popular. I don't know how it would work out. I mean, I think that it could mean we get like really big improvements to the law, could mean that we get stuff that's crazy. But I do think that I think something like that, I think would be potentially good.
Because the question is, would it succeed in taking some pressure off? You know, so presumably we get good and bad stuff. Who knows? Probably a lot of it would be bad from my point of view. But would it succeed in taking the pressure off trying to get the same bad stuff in a worse way?
Yeah, I guess it depends. I guess it depends on sort of the breakdown. Like it could be that like society, there's things in which society is like really closely divided, like 51-49 or something. And the court can either make those things happen or like freeze them in their tracks. And the fact that, you know, a supermajority of people could change the result doesn't necessarily mean anything if like society is really closely divided. And so the stakes of the court are still very high.
Although maybe it also changes the way some of the justices think about, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it would be interesting. I'll say that.
Well.
And I think maybe a lot depends on the specifics of what it would look like. But I mean, I think in general, I share the inclination that, you know, right now, part of the problem is that like we're asking them to do much. We expect them to do too much, the justices, and figuring out some way to like make them less significant and make, you know, the stakes of what they're doing less significant would be healthy for democracy and just, you know, be healthy for the political process.
Yeah.
So not bad. But again, none of those are going to happen, right? Because it's so hard to amend the Constitution.
I mean, who knows what will happen? I guess maybe this is a version of your original point. I think it's usually a mistake to write off even constitutional amendments because a lot of the constitutional amendments that have happened to the Constitution have been, you know, were repeatedly proposed and shot down over and over again until suddenly they weren't. You know,
like yeah. I mean,
reforming the Senate. Everybody always said the Senate will never agree to direct elections. You know, our direct elections amendment will never happen because we have to go through the Senate. And why would they agree to that? And indeed, they shot it down like 171 times or something. And then eventually they didn't.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think I'll say this, which is that I cannot imagine these kinds of amendments passing until we are in a different political moment that is not polarized in the same way as we are right now. And if we are in that different political moment, it is harder for me to know whether we need these reforms or different ones.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I guess, right. Well, ideally, what you'd like are proposals that can serve as a focal point for trying to organize us and getting out of our polarization. I think this is the one thing I'd ever written about court reform before this. Is this sort of how I feel about term limits? I think term limits are probably a bad idea for the Supreme Court. They're probably mostly harmless, but to the extent they have any consequences, they're probably bad. But a term limits constitutional amendment, I could imagine being salutary because I could imagine a world where that becomes the political conversation that helps us that helps us get to a better place. You know, that like that becomes the thing, that a way to think about getting us all to agree on what we want from the court in a better way.
It produces some common ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, again, I totally share, you know, I don't know if I agree with you about the criticisms of term limits or whether doing that would produce that kind of benefit. But I definitely agree with that motivation. But I think part of the problem is, you know, how do we even agree on what the things are we should agree on? And Ganesh and I have kind of an exchange with a friend of the show, Steve Sachs. He wrote a response to our original piece, and then we have a follow-up where we sort of respond to him. And so his argument is, look, the problem is the court is, we see it as this court is the super weapon that can do whatever it wants. And of course, in that world, like, people are going to fight tooth and nail over controlling it, right? If you can, you know, if the court has this like magic power. And I think that's right. I mean, the question is, what's the solution? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Steve sort of says the solution is, like, you know, let's converge on, you know, the legal materials and real consensus. But then our view is like, well, that just ends up looking like you're just saying, you know, originalism is the solution. And that's kind of, you know, for people on the left who don't buy into that, that's not the solution, right? That's just surrender. And so I don't know how to do it. I do agree that it is, like, trying to do that is important. But the other thing that's hard is, like, if you also want to be able to, like, call out stuff that you see as bad or that makes you angry, and you don't want to just be like, okay, well, everything this court is doing is great and totally, totally fine. If you really, really fundamentally disagree with the whole project, you disagree with the way in which, you know, the court's majority was obtained. And so, I don't know, it's a real challenge for me to think about, like, the right way to do that.
So to tie into where we started the show, I think Roe versus Wade also casts a huge and complicated gravitational shadow over these debates. So I think there are a lot of people whose general message on the court and to the commission was sort of like, the Supreme Court judicial review bad. You know, we should, on the whole, the Supreme Court has done more mischief than good in the constitutional arena. They could be in favor of a different kind of de-escalation, like strong Thayerianism, strong deference to legislatures, except for Roe, which very few people on the left are willing to openly give up on, even though some of them may say that privately. So it'll be interesting to see. This is not the most important thing to consider if Roe versus Wade is overruled, but I do think one of the conversations, you know, will that then free up the space for a more just forthrightly anti-judicial review progressive wing? So now I'll be like, we used to be keeping the court around for this one thing, and now they're not even doing the one thing, we can move on? Or will it do the opposite? Will it, you know, will the fight to recover Roe sort of destroy judicial deference forever?
Yeah, I tend to think maybe it's going to be the second thing more than the first, but I'm not sure. I'll say that I am someone who is like, you can be more worried about courts doing bad stuff, or you can be more worried about them not doing good stuff. And I'm sort of more of the, like, I'm worried about them doing bad stuff, like striking down stuff I think that is good, rather than like not striking down stuff I think that's bad. Obviously, you know, most people want the court to do a mix of those things, but like, you have, most people have like one thing that's like, this is the thing they're really worried about. I'm worried about, you know, I want the court to be counter-majoritarian, striking down things, or I want the court to not stand in the way of democracy. And I am more in the second group. But
Me too.
Good, but
not for the same reasons, I think, but
I'm sure not. I'm sure it's because originalism commands that or something. I don't know.
He who asserts must prove.
Flesh that out for me.
I think for the Supreme Court to take the step of disregarding a statute is to make an assertion, a stronger assertion than merely applying a statute. Like, you know, and that then the burden of proof falls on them. That's like just a core, you know, a fundamental way to understand an institution's place in the world is that you need a justification to change the status quo.
Yeah, although that doesn't answer the question of whether you think there could be that you think that there are really good justifications in some cases, and it's really bad for the court not to find those. Like, this, that doesn't answer this question, right?
The base, that means for me, the baseline, the like err on the side of caution, the first do no evil is that. Now, I'm not sure that the Supreme Court's worst decisions ever are all ones invalidating statutes rather than, you know, failing to find rights. But I think the fundamental principle of judicial power is that he who asserts must prove.
Yeah. What's in the so-called anti-canon? I mean, some of those are cases that where the court failed to protect rights. So Plessy versus Ferguson.
It's two and two. Lochner, Plessy, Korematsu, Dred Scott.
Okay. So yeah, Dred Scott, they do exercise the power of judicial review. Lochner, same. Korematsu, they refuse to find the in Japanese interment unconstitutional. So that's, yeah, that's interesting.
They don't. Yeah.
Yeah.
I assume that's actually, it's a tidy feature of the anti-canon that it's two on each side. So it's,
yeah. But it is an accurate, this is, Jamal Green's article the first place that really comes up with this? But I feel like the assignment of the cases is correct, right? That seems correct to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at the time he wrote the article, Korematsu had not been officially overruled by the Court of History. So there was like Korematsu was this awkward one. Yeah, and
don't get me
and started. Lochner's awkward in a different way, and that it's the least clear exactly why Lochner is wrong, even if everybody agrees it's wrong. And it's also maybe not wrong, but.
And Lochner's coming back, right?
I might be becoming pro Lochner, which makes me really uncomfortable. I mean, yeah.
We might need do you have like a privileges or immunities?
I started a paper on the original meaning of the privileges or immunities clause, and I don't have it nailed down yet, but Lochner is plausible.
I could see it. I mean, Lochner bothers me less than some other stuff. There's a lot of crazy economic protectionism that wouldn't be the end of the world to have the court kind of take a closer look at. But other stuff, the idea that the court is going to strike down, you know, healthcare and stuff like that strikes me. I'm more worried about stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting to see how the kind of anti-judicial review set of ideas, you know, how much that currency that will pick up on the left. It's already picked up some steam compared to where we were a decade ago, 5 years ago. But is that going to continue, or is the debate all going to be around how do we get more Democratic appointed justices on the court so they can bring Roe back?
Right.
This is the thing I find so
powerful about the kind of the nuclear weapons analogy, right? I think we may disagree on what the path to nuclear disarmament looks like.
Yeah.
But I think it's good to try to find one.
Yes.
Before we blow each other up.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, another view you could have is like, it's good for people to just blow the court up because, you know, the court, you know, it's not necessarily good for the court to be super, super legitimate, be able to do whatever it wants. Actually, maybe if the court has less legitimacy, we just have more democratic self-government. And I thought there's an interesting thing about, sorry, I've interrupted you, but the interesting thing about the argument in Dobbs is some of the justices, the Democratic justices, are talking really openly about like, this is going to look really bad for us. This is going to have a stench on it if we are seen as being persuaded by politics. And one response to that is like, you know, that's like the court looking good is not the most important thing here, right? Like, I don't think like that should be, maybe that shouldn't even be a consideration. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I kind of agree. But in the nuclear weapons analogy, the Supreme Court, the radiation damage is not limited to the Supreme Court.
Yes, that's
the Supreme Court is the nuclear weapon, and we are the victims.
Yeah, that's fair. And I do, in How to Save the Supreme Court, a first piece on this, you know, we do make an argument about Supreme Court legitimacy, and our claim is that, you know, if the Supreme Court loses legitimacy, that may delegitimize law more generally, and that I'm more worried about. Okay, so we've talked a lot about this. Do you have any kind of takeaways? Are you glad you did this? How much time did this take?
I don't know. I learned a lot in doing this, although mostly I think unintentional lessons. So I suppose I'm glad I did it, but if I were asked to serve on another presidential commission in the future, I'd probably want to have some more, I'd have some more pointed questions to ask about what exactly we were doing. I do worry a little bit, I guess. The thing I feel worst about is you, Dan. I worry about all of the law professors who we got to put on suits and spend weeks over their summer vacation writing us incredibly insightful and well-researched things under the impression that we were going to do something other than what we did. And if I try to count up the total number of sort of like legal genius man hours spent producing this report, I think it's pretty hard to justify.
Okay, well, just in fairness, I wasn't really under any illusions about what the commission was going to do, I think. I think I saw it clearly.
And so how'd you do it?
I don't know. Like, well, first of all, like, why? I mean, if I don't do it, it looks like I'm mad that I'm not on the commission, right? Like, it's kind of insulting to people, or it makes me look dumb. And I don't know. It looks good to do it, and I don't mind doing it. I've got stuff to say. It gave me an opportunity to kind of crystallize some stuff. You know, and I probably spent a week writing my testimony, maybe less than a week, but
think of all the movies you could have watched.
Yeah, but now I'm going to turn that into, I'm going to turn it into a short symposium article. So it's all going to work out.
Good. I'm glad you're not mad, at least about that.
I mean, you know, I would feel differently about the whole commission, you know, if it had come out with this, you know, guns blazing report, you know, just casting doubt on a bunch of stuff and reaching a bunch of conclusions that I disagreed with. But, you know.
Me too. And actually, so now having said, I will say, I think it's really important that the commission did not come out with a report with guns blazing in the other direction either, endorsing the view that the Supreme Court needs to be burned down and all this stuff.
And it was never going to do that, given, you know, like you would have resigned, right? You would have resigned. I mean,
that's just it. If my presence in the commission helped that not happen, then I am glad I did it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the commission. That's the report.
Yeah. It's not going to be available at any bookstore, as far as I can understand. I believe we only had the budget to print 200 copies.
Are those going to be like sold on eBay? How many do you get? You get one? There's a lot of other people. With 200 copies, there's only 34 commissioners. Where are the rest of them going?
Congress and the White House.
Okay. Can I like buy one?
No.
They won't print one on print on demand? Come on. This is the 21st century.
I believe there are GSA regs that would forbid that. Now, the PDF is not copyrightable. So actually, I do think somebody could set up an Amazon shop where you could print it on demand. And I don't know. Should we put that? We could do it and put it in the divided argument store, I guess. But.
Law firm style. I put it in a binder. I've got a binder. But yeah, wouldn't mind having a bound edition on my shelf for future reference. Although I probably just end up using the PDF anyways. Wow. Greatest country in the world. We can only print 200 copies of this lengthy report. All right. Well, should we wrap it up?
Yeah.
Thanks very much for listening. And if you haven't yet, please rate and review on the Apple Podcast Store and anywhere else you listen to your podcasts. Send the podcast to your friends. Get some merchandise at our website, dividedargument.com, and buy some stickers or t-shirts so everyone knows what you're listening to. And thanks.
Thanks to the Constitutional Law Institute for sponsoring our endeavors. And thanks, as always, to Dan for putting up with me.
And if we don't come out with a new episode soon, it will be because the president has forbidden us to speak about things. All right. And so, like, every time we just come up with an excuse like that.
Yeah, that's good.